Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Malcolm Graham is a member of Charlotte City Council. He's also been a member of the State Senate. Leadership tests you. Taking stands on issues tests you. But nothing tested Malcolm Graham like the death of his sister, Cynthia Graham Hurd. She was murdered, along with eight others, in the massacre that occurred at Charleston's Emmanuel AME Church 10 years ago today, June 17th, 2015. She and others were shot and killed during Bible study by a young man who they invited into their midst. It has been a decade since that fateful day, and many, if not most people, have moved on. Not Malcolm. He writes, "I can say with both sadness and certainty that I have not moved on. I won't. Not yet. There's work yet to do where I stand." Those sentences come from his new book, The Way Forward, Keeping the Faith and Doing the Work Amid Hatred and Violence. In it, he offers his reflections on the senseless, racist violence that occurred that day and explores his personal journey in coming to terms with it. It examines loss, resilience, and social justice and calls for recognition, reform, and reconciliation. On this 10th anniversary of that tragic day, a conversation with Malcolm Graham about all of this and more. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
We have spoken about this in the past, I think on the first anniversary of your sister's death and in other subsequent times. And you haven't, and the fact that you haven't been able to get past this, you haven't been able to reach a point where you are willing to forgive. And I have to ask you, why should you?
Well, I shouldn't, right? Cynthia would have said that what occurred 10 years ago was an attack on a race of people. It didn't matter who they were or what their backgrounds were. The only thing that they that mattered, that they were there and that they were Black. And I like my Blackness. I love my Black history. And what he wanted to do was to extinguish a race of people. You can't forgive that. You can't forgive centuries of the same type of affliction that occurred that night to the African-American community, going back to slavery or Jim Crow or whatever time in space. And so, no, I can't forgive that. And
do you want to?
I don't focus on that. I focus on Cynthia and how she lived and who she loved and the impact she made in our community here in Charleston. And she often came to Charlotte and helped me politically. And the eight others, I knew six of those as well, really well. And so, no, I focus on them and their legacy and their life, and I don't give a hoot about Dylann Roof.
Yeah. At the bond hearing for your sister's murderer, you write about the judge inviting the victims' families to speak. You were, I think, listening on the radio, on satellite radio or something, to the coverage as you were driving to or from Charleston, I've forgotten which. And you say that all of those family members spoke of forgiveness. You say that you almost wrecked the car. And you add, quote, "It was all just so Charleston. The white magistrate's thinly veiled racist comments, the Black folks turning the other cheek and trying to make peace, and the world's readiness to take the way out." And you say that you could hear your sister's voice saying, "No, no, no, we can't just forgive." And that's when you decided to be your sister's voice in all of this. If she wouldn't have offered forgiveness, why should you? How do you know she wouldn't have, if all the other families stepped forward and said, "We have to forgive"?
Well, all the families didn't, right? There was maybe three or four families that forgave. That's one of the misconceptions that really came out of Charleston, that everyone forgave. Not true. Cynthia would have wanted to create an environment where healthy tension could occur, right, where we ask tough questions and allow people to sit in the discomfort of the answers and the question posed. Cynthia was a confidant, a big sister, a political advisor. We talked every day. We talked about history. We talked about Charleston. We talked about our families. We talked about politics and issues. We talked about the Confederate flag still being flown in South Carolina. And so she had a sense of history. She was a librarian. She did research. And so all those conversations led me to believe with certainty that she would say, no, we're not going to do that right now. Cynthia was still in the morgue.
In an article that you wrote, I think recently, just days ago, for the Charleston News and Courier, the newspaper down there, you say, quote, as Emanuel's congregation showed the world, we must practice radical forgiveness and love. Forgiveness is not forgetting, nor is it excusing evil. It is the decision to break the cycle of hate and choose hope over despair. It sounds like the path that you're on, which we'll talk about because that's part of this book, is leading you toward forgiveness. I mean, you just talked about not being able to forgive, but then you say forgiveness is not forgetting, nor is it excusing evil. It's the decision to break the cycle.
Yeah. And so both can be true. With certainty, I don't forgive Dylann Roof, right? And I don't think I can ever do that. But my faith walk is different than others. And as others choose to forgive, I hold no ill feelings. Someone who lost their mom or their sister in this shooting, I know that pain. And I know what they're going through. And if they choose to, through their faith, say they forgive, I'm okay with that. Not for me.
You've mentioned his name,
yeah,
the murderer, several times in this conversation, and there have been so many mass murders in America that the media has, some in the media, mm-hmm. have taken the stance that we're not going to mention the perpetrator's mm-hmm. name, because why should that perpetrator live? Mm-hmm. Why should that name have mm-hmm. any cachet or have any, mm-hmm. any notoriety whatsoever? How do you feel about it? Because you continue to use it.
Well, you know, it's history, right? And part of that history is you need to explain it fully, right? And so just like so many individuals in current times, 2025, want to put Black history aside, not talk about it, sanitize it, I don't think we need to sanitize what happened 10 years ago. I think people need to know exactly what happened. I think people need to know exactly who committed the crime, who were the victims of it, and the impact it had on the city of Charleston.
Let's refresh people's memories. I know it's certainly fresh in your memory, but maybe so much has happened in this country in 10 years that it's almost impossible to remember everything. But Dylann Roof was a kid. Mm-hmm. The crux of his actions were basic, heinous racism. Mm-hmm. Full stop. But he came to AME Church and was invited in to Bible study. It's a Black church. Why did they invite this white kid in?
Well, the church is in close proximity to the College of Charleston, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's right in the heart of the central business, commercial, entertainment district of the city. And so it's not unusual for people to come in and sit in the Bible study. And so when he entered the church and asked to sit in, he was welcome. They've done that before to other visitors who've come to be a part of the church experience. The church is a welcoming church. Come as you are. And so he was welcome.
Do we know if he participated in any way in that Bible study or whether he just waited for his moment?
He sat quietly and listened. There was no comment from him from what I know and what I heard during the trial in terms of him actively participating. Mm-hmm. I just sat quietly and listened.
Because racism was at the crux of this and because he was invited in, strangers took, they just welcomed him in to be part of their study. And it was taking place in a church, a place of worship. Does that make this even more heinous? Does it make the place and circumstances even more difficult for people to get past what he did and forgive?
I think it really makes it difficult, right? Emmanuel AME Church has been in the fabric of my family for 50, 60 years. It's a place where all of those individuals felt probably the most comfortable at. It's a church, right? They're worshiping God. They're celebrating their religion and celebrating community. And for something of this nature to happen at the church was unthinkable, right? Racism, hatred, discrimination, gunfire, 77 shots. Unthinkable. Where was God? How could this happen in the church? And so it questions a lot of theories from my perspective and that folks had to deal with. An attack on the race of people, an attack on the black church.
This is going to sound like a stupid question, and I don't mean it to be this way, but I'm curious about whether or not the things that came out of this have helped in any way, because what came out of this was President Obama coming to that church, giving the eulogy, several other black civil rights leaders being there. The Confederate flag was taken down at the State House in Columbia in the aftermath of all of this. Has any of that helped? Has it changed anything? Did any purpose come out of this that may not have happened had this not occurred?
That's an interesting question. Obviously, I think the whole nation embraced their humanity. I think the whole country and even internationally, people understood what happened there. We've taken marginal steps forward.
And marginal steps backwards.
Huge steps backwards. Because keep in mind, 6 years after Charleston, something similar happened in Buffalo, right, where 10 individuals, white guy goes into a black neighborhood, identifies a black grocery store, uses a gun with the name of Dylan Roof inscribed on it, and kills 10 black folks. Yeah. And so mixed emotions about that question. Even Obama, right, his election twice was a turning point in this country. The best of times where we all came together as a nation to move progressively forward. The worst of times, people couldn't accept the changing demographics and wanted to go back to a time where America was great.
Yeah.
And so a lot of things happening.
I want to talk about where America stands in your mind today. But before we do that, I want to find out about you, because you say in your book that the way forward doesn't begin with knowing your destination. It begins with where you stand. And you say, if I understand this correctly, that even those people who believe that they have moved on are actually standing where you stand, whether they know it or not. Where do you stand?
I stand on trying to fight for the survival of a race of people, right? And you look at current times, don't teach black history, limited. Don't celebrate black excellence, take it away. History of white Afrikaners are welcome to the country and black and brown people are exported from the country. DEI, bad word. No acceptance of the changing demographics of our country. Good people on all sides. I stand with fighting for a race of people, fighting for their survival, fighting to improve systems. Dr. King said, pay little attention to the killer, but more attention to the system that produced the killers. When he gave the eulogy at the 16th Avenue Baptist Church for the little girls killed in the bomb by a Klansman.
Yeah. Malcolm Graham is our guest. His book is called The Way Forward, Keeping the Faith and Doing the Work Amid Hatred and Violence. And we'll talk about where America stands when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Charlotte City Councilman Malcolm Graham. His sister Cynthia died at the hands of a murderer 10 years ago today. She was among 9 people murdered at Charleston's AME church on this day. In your book, you write about, and he's written a book about this called The Way Forward. In that book, you write about listening to Judge James Gosnell's opening monologue at Dylan Roof's bond hearing shortly after he was arrested, saying, quote, "We have victims, 9 of them, but we also have victims on the other side, on this young man's side of the family." Nothing about that statement is false, but you found it difficult to believe that he found it necessary to salve the wounds of the Roof family while black families sat in the courtroom, and they were the true victims of this. In the decades since that day, in Charleston, racism, suspicion of the other, even hatred has been allowed to seep out of the shadows. After the neo-Nazi march in Charlottesville during the first Trump administration, Donald Trump said that there were good people on both sides. Is America moving forward? Are we standing still? Are we regressing?
I think American stands divided, and I think this past weekend was a perfect example of that. Marches all over the country protesting the administration, military parade on Saturday celebrating his administration. And so we stand divided as a country. We cannot face reality based on our changing demographics.
Why?
Because white men in particular want to remain in control and power.
But isn't that delusional? I mean, if it's inevitable.
Well, I agree. I think we agree on that, right? But it doesn't stop people from preventing it. It doesn't stop people from exploiting all the black and brown people out of the country.
And some say because it is delusional and because they are bound and determined to try to stop this in some way, the only way to stop it is through making the government more authoritarian. Do you believe that's true, and do you believe that could happen?
I believe it's true, and I believe that it is happening, right? When you look at current events, right, current events doesn't lie. I mean, taking the names of battleships that were named after African-Americans or brown people or Jewish folks, DEI, right, black excellence, right? We're not identifying the worst of the worst. These are the best of the best, right? If you look for hard enough, you can find them, right? That's what DEI is all about. And so it's going.
Well, why do you suppose there are black politicians who support that effort?
Well, I think they are just misguided and confused.
How can they be misguided? These are intelligent people. They are allegedly leaders. They are people who study policy and run for election because one presumes they want to make a difference. It's not just they want to get rich or become famous, one presumes. But why would they support that? Tim Scott comes to mind.
Well, you know, the proximity to power, right?
To what end?
To the end of themselves, right? They self-inflicted wounds, right? And Tim Scott made a lot of promises 10 years ago, hadn't kept any of them in terms of passing the Charleston loophole or helping get hate crime passed in the state of South Carolina. I believe firmly that if those 9 individuals didn't die, the Confederate flag would still be flying in South Carolina today. And so, you know, people, all skin folks and kin folks, as we would say.
Do you think it's deliberate? Or do you think that the people who want to make America great again and to take it back to a time when they think it was great, which was probably a time when it was also incredibly unfair, that they think about that is one of their motivations, or is that just a side effect that they haven't considered?
They know exactly what they're doing. I don't think it's they know that back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, I think they think American was great for them, but it wasn't great for the African-American community.
Do they view it as a zero-sum game?
They view it as, I want to take care of me.
So we are witnessing this retrenchment. I don't think that's even arguable. It is what it is, a desire to return to a place in our past that was unfair by design. And you wrote in the Charleston Post and Courier that we are, quote, witnessing an assault on the very principles that can help us heal. Diversity, equity, and inclusion are under attack in many corners. Efforts to ensure that Black history is taught, you've alluded to this, fully and truthfully are being rolled back. The U.S. Justice Department, which should be a bulwark against civil rights violations, is scaling back on lawyers and investigations that protect our most fundamental freedoms. You say this is a struggle over who we want to be, and the title of your book includes the words, "Doing the Work Amid Hatred and Violence." What is the work, and who should be doing it?
I think all of us should be doing the work. The work is really, from my perspective, tackling hurdles within systems, right? The education system, the healthcare system, the employment system, right? All those things that kill, literally, African-Americans on a day-to-day basis. Not like going into a church and killing 9 folks in Charleston or 10 folks in Buffalo, 6, 8, 9, 10 years apart. But every day through systems, the African-American community is being hurt. You know, one of the things that the killer wanted to do was start a race war, right? And, you know, you have to ask yourself, has the war already started? And we just don't know it, right? When you look at police shootings, unarmed African Americans. When you look at the young man in Atlanta running and being chased by 2 white guys and killed because he was looking into a house under construction. When you look at what happened in Charleston, in Buffalo, or the Jewish synagogue in Pittsburgh, you can go on and on. If you put all these pieces together, there's a clear puzzle. Black folks, South Carolina, North Carolina, not passing Medicaid expansion, not getting health care, artificial barriers that prevent people from voting. All these impact the African-American community specifically, and is literally, in some cases, diminishing us as a race. And maybe the war has already started. I'm not sure.
Well, you talk about people walking a well-worn circle of injustice and forgiveness. Slavery ended 160 years ago. The Civil Rights Act was passed 60 years ago. Martin Luther King Jr. talked about the arc of the moral universe always bending toward justice. But there's a famous song from the Civil Rights Movement, "We Shall Overcome," which was sung at every march and rally that took place in the civil rights movement of the 60s. And yet, you're still talking about overcoming. Do you get tired of waiting for the arc of the moral universe to tilt toward justice?
Yes. I get tired of our race being constantly under attack. And you know, Dr. King also said, community or chaos. And we have to find... you asked the question about doing the work. The work is about building a better community for all of us, or we're going to have chaos in this country. I am convinced that there's more good people than bad people in America. And all the good people got to, you know, get off their knees, dry their eyes, keep the faith, and then do the work. Because the work is constant. The work is hard. The work is right in front of us. And whether you're black or white or rich or poor or young and all, you got to be committed to doing it.
And the work is what? What should we be working? How should we be? What should we be doing?
We got to create some healthy tension. We got to create, speak truth to power. We got to call out racism. Discrimination and hatred when we see it, whether it's at our dinner tables at home or at our workplace or at our social clubs. We got to have the fortitude to say something and then do something. We just can't be quiet about it.
Your book, which came out in March, and we're having this conversation on the 10th anniversary of your sister's death, your book, The Way Forward, talks about your sister. It talks about what happened that day. It talks about the aftermath of what happened that day. And it also lays out some prescriptions that I hope to get to before the end of this conversation about how we do the work and where we need to head in order to stop this kind of nonsense from going on. And I want to talk about that, but I'm curious about some of the very personal things that you write about in this book, including when it comes to your sister's husband. You had a very... strained relationship with him, and I don't believe you've spoken to him in the last 10 years, if I'm accurate about that. He sounds to me, the way you paint his picture, as a user who had a drug problem and who used your sister. You talk about forgiveness and finding a way forward to peaceful coexistence in this book and an end to senseless racism and violence. So why include those details about him and your relationship with him and how his relationship with your sister was? Why talk about that?
I think it's important because, you know, Cynthia lived a full life, right? And a lot of people, when they looked at the Charleston incident 10 years ago, didn't understand the personal struggles that all the families had. Mm-hmm. You know, when someone dies under the best of times, right, surrounded by family and friends, that person know that they're going to pass. There's certain preparations you can do, right? This was sudden, and Cynthia was a fixer. She thought she can fix everything. She couldn't fix him. And the last time I spoke with him was the day of Cynthia's funeral, actually. And he misappropriated her will, never produced it. And even when the city council in Charleston was going to name the library after her, this was two, three days after the shooting, a room full of people, media from all over the country. The proclamation was to Cynthia Graham Hurd, St. Andrews Regional Library, and he gets up and say, hey, I want to change it to the Cynthia Hurd Regional Library, right? And so everyone in the room is stunned. Council members looking awkward. Library folks are upset. My family members literally ready to do bodily harm. Mm-hmm. And I had to calm everyone down and say, listen, we can't be the family.
What was the final decision on that?
They passed it as he requested. The library refused to put the name on the building for a year. Me being a public official knew that we can go back and change it. And about 10, 11 months later, in a consent agenda, which the council votes on like 30, 40 items at one time, it was slipped in to change it back to the Cynthia Graham Hurd St. Andrews Regional Library 3 days after the sign went up on the building.
So the motive for these killings, these nine murders, senseless murders, was racism, but the method was gun violence.
Yeah.
The nation continues to suffer an almost never-ending series of gun violence incidences. The Minnesota Speaker of the House was murdered this past weekend with her husband, and another member of that body was wounded along with his wife. We used to talk about these incidents as possible catalysts for gun legislation. We know now that that's not going to happen. It simply is not going to happen, particularly in this political environment. But when gun violence occurs, we are shielded from what really happens to the victims. We think of it as what we see on television and in movies, where the shot is fired, the person falls, that's the end of it. That is not the way it is. And in your book, you write, I'll spare you the details and simply tell you how many times each person was shot. But understand this, these people weren't simply shot, they were mutilated at close range. The bullets did not move cleanly through their bodies. They shattered and fragmented and shredded their way through. In other incidents, we are told, it is almost impossible to identify the victims because of the damage that these bullets do to people. And yet we are shielded from it. We are not shown this. Those pictures are blurred on television and in the newspapers. Do you think if more Americans became actually aware, if they saw with their own eyes what these bullets do, that something would change, that there would be legislation?
I think so.
Well, then why not? Why shield people from it? I'll spare you the details. Why?
Out of respect for the victims, right? For sure.
But there'll be more victims.
Well, Las Vegas, Orlando, Sutherland, Texas, California,
Pittsburgh.
You can call the roll of cities that have been impacted by this. Kids, church members, moviegoers, right? Doesn't matter. People who are just quietly living their lives. It's complicated, Mike, right? You want to respect the victims, and but at the same time, I think you may be onto something that it was horrific. 77 shots were fired in that church within a matter of minutes. You know, when I talked to President Obama, you know, we talked about that, right? We talked about gun violence and the mixture of guns and hatred and racism and discrimination and the victims and how much do we share visually and it's tough. And I try not to put myself in the room that night, but I have over the years. So it's tough.
You have some prescriptions for change in this book, 7 steps to the way forward, and one of them is strengthening gun control measures. You're calling for, quote, sensible gun control measures. What does that mean?
Well, it's a lot easier to get a gun than it is to buy a car, right? You got to get car insurance, and you got to get driver's lessons, and you got to, you know, you renew it every 4 to 6 years.
But it's odd because you have no right, no constitutional right to drive a car.
Yeah.
But you have a constitutional right to bear arms.
Yeah. Within reason. So I think if the founding fathers were living today, they'll say, wait a minute, you guys are getting it twisted, right? You can have it's not limitless, right? There's got to be some framework, some boundaries to this thing. And so, we need stronger gun legislation, both at the federal level as well as the local level. We made some progress on that, but certainly not enough.
In the 10 years since that incident took place and your sister lost her life, has there been any meaningful gun legislation here or elsewhere?
Not from my perspective. You know, you still can buy a gun with little or no fanfare. The city of Charlotte itself is still, every day, last night there was a shooting in Charlotte, and I don't know the details, but probably it was a stolen gun, and the person didn't buy it, probably was given away to him or, you know, whatever, and so that's where we are.
I want to follow up on that when we come back from the break and also go through some of these other things that you think we can do to make some substantive change. Malcolm Graham is our guest. His book is called The Way Forward. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Malcolm Graham, Charlotte City Council's Malcolm Graham, is our guest. His book is called The Way Forward, Keeping the Faith and Doing the Work Amid Hatred and Violence. He wrote it because his sister Cynthia was among the 9 people who were murdered in Charleston, South Carolina, 10 years ago today at the AME Church Massacre, the Mother Emanuel Church. Before we move on to your prescriptions, among them, which is, one of them is the strengthening gun control measures, if the Mother Emanuel murders in Bible study did not move the needle, if kids at an elementary school being massacred did not move the needle, if people in nightclubs and music festivals being killed by high-powered rifles have not moved the needle, what will?
I'm not sure. I know we got to continue to work towards it.
Will anything move the needle?
No. I think we are stuck in this environment where guns rules, and be damned with the results or the impact.
And what does that mean? I mean, what does that mean for the country? What does that mean for our society? What does that say about us?
It means that we're going to wake up one morning and there'll be a shooting in somewhere USA. and more people will die. There'll be more funerals. There'll be more news media rushing to Nowhere USA to report it.
And it doesn't shock us anymore, Malcolm. It used to shock us. One single shooting, one single person being shot in a city would stop that city for weeks, maybe a month. And people would be talking about, well, this is not us. This is us. This is who we are.
This is who we are. And like I said, we don't care anymore. Mm-hmm. Kids, churchgoers, moviegoers, we don't care.
If we don't care about that, then what do we care about?
Power, control.
And where does that lead us?
Community or chaos leads us to chaos.
So some of your book is devoted to prescriptions for improvement, for change. And step one for moving forward is to acknowledge the nation's collective grief. And again, the grief you're talking about is that experienced by families of victims of hate crimes and gun violence. Does that happen already? Don't politicians on the regular offer up their thoughts and prayers after these incidences? Don't people express, individuals express their personal condolences to people who have lost family members? And yet it continues. I'm certain that you experienced tons of people coming up to you and expressing their condolences. Does that help? And if so, how?
Well, some of it is performative. Thoughts and prayers. Tim Scott comes to mind for sure. Right after Charleston shooting, said all the right things and did nothing.
Hasn't that lost its value by now? Thoughts and prayers. Yeah. If you're not going to do anything, thoughts and prayers become meaningless.
It means nothing, right? From those who have the power or the influence to change things. But I don't want to throw a whole lot of water on it, because everyday people, when they see me in the bank or the grocery store or a Panthers game, even 10 years later, strangers sometimes would come up and say, hey, I'm thinking about you. I'm thinking about your family. Or grab my hand and squeeze it and say, I understand.
Those are nice people.
Yes.
But people, as you point out, people in power who say those things and then don't do anything about it, are they nice people?
They are misguided and more interested in holding a seat. I often say, Mike, even in my public career, if I don't do anything or say anything that puts my seat in jeopardy, then I'm just going for a walk, right? I'm not making a difference, right? And so you got to be able to speak up and say something and do something.
So when you talk about acknowledging the nation's grief, what are you talking about?
That we are, as a country, hurting. People are literally hurting. People are dying. People aren't dying, because Cynthia didn't die. Right. She was healthy. Mm-hmm. She was getting ready to celebrate her 55th birthday. Her birthday is June 22nd. So we were talking about her double nickel, right? Mm-hmm. She didn't die. She was killed.
Right.
People are being killed. And so we have to embrace that as a country and say no more. And I keep on going back to that simple statement, community or chaos, because we're in this worn circle of thoughts and prayers, chaos, thoughts and pray, chaos, and no one wants to break the cycle.
And you say that step two is to foster community healing and reconciliation, and I'm guessing that you're talking about having open dialogue about the things that disturb us or that divide us, et cetera, in safe spaces with people participating in that conversation. There have been companies that have been participating now for years in these DEI programs, and you say that now that that's been kind of scrapped by a lot of these companies at presidential fiat, that they should pool their money. These companies should pool their monies that they have devoted to DEI and give it to libraries to conduct similar programs based on individual community needs. As someone who has participated in discussions over city policy at these community meetings, does this work? I mean, aren't these sessions normally attended by the choir, and you're just preaching to the choir, people who are already invested, already interested in what's going on, and those who are not interested or who take an opposing point of view simply don't come?
Yeah, we got to do it. I was in Charleston last night, community conversation. My sister's foundation last Thursday held a community conversation with Bakari Sellers and others in Charleston. We got to work. We got to talk. We got to create healthy tension. We got to do what the bishop did at the National Prayer Breakfast when Trump was there and Vice President was there and all his family members were there, and she spoke her truth. Very eloquently, mm-hmm. very quietly, didn't raise her voice, didn't have a picket sign in her hand. She created an environment where healthy tension could exist.
And what impact did that have, looking back?
That people will be pushing back then. People pushed back this weekend with the No Kings rally, that people will have to organize and galvanize to get their point across.
You talk about step three being addressing the root causes. In the case of your sister's murder, racism, that was the bottom line. Mm-hmm. You say that many racist ideas and actions come from irrational fear, and today we know that that fear is being stoked mm-hmm. by politicians at the highest levels and by those that profit mm-hmm. from that fear. So how do you accomplish addressing the root causes in that environment?
It's what you just articulated, as well as, I think, systems, right? We talked about that earlier in the conversation about what King said. Let's focus on the systems. You live in a good zip code, your child probably goes to a good school. The wrong zip code, you don't. Healthcare. If you go to UNC Charlotte and your name is Sarah and you got a 3.8, and if you go to Johnson C. Smith and your name is Jasmine, you got 3.8, Sarah gets lots of interviews, Jasmine's still waiting for a call back, right? So we got to be able to work through systems, employment, education, healthcare, criminal justice, to ensure that every American, black, white, rich, poor, are getting a fair shake.
You also talk about promoting empathy, understanding, and education. Empathy is incredibly short supply right now.
Yeah.
And we're a nation where that's going on. It's led us, I think, to the precipice of being willing to chuck democracy. We're also witnessing attacks on education and a reluctance to understand each other. How do you reverse that?
Well, it's funny. It's hard, right? I mean, these things, Mike, you know, and I wrote, they're not... they've been said before in some forms of fashion, but it's hard work. How do you get people to care?
if they don't care and there's no empathy for the other and they don't want to know things because it might shake their worldview, you are kind of stuck.
Yeah, we got this thing that we got to figure out. It's not easy. I you know, it's.
Are you optimistic?
I'm hopeful.
Should you be?
I gotta be. Right? What's the alternative? I got a 4 and 2 year old grandson now, and Lord knows I hope that they won't be dealing with some of the same issues, having the same conversations.
Won't they be? I've been alive for a long time.
I hope not.
You talk about the need to foster community engagement and active citizenship, and that includes increasing the number of people who vote. You say that the number of eligible voters who did not vote in 2024 is staggering. And Mecklenburg County, where you live,
yeah.
We have one of the lowest voter turnouts anywhere in the state of North Carolina. Do you understand why or how to reverse it?
If we would just vote our numbers. If we would just vote out.
But people don't vote.
They don't vote. They're not engaged. And again, one of those things that we got to begin to change the gas in our voting car from regular to premium and get folks to the polls. Wide variety of efforts. Lots of money being spent to do just that.
Well, one reason, I think, and you can take issue with this, I suppose, is lack of trust in government and in governmental and elected officials. Some believe that there's not a dime's worth difference between the Democratic candidate and the Republican candidate, or the political parties. They are all, they just think that everybody who runs for office and who holds office is just in it for themselves, for power, for money, for whatever, and that no matter who you vote for, nothing is going to change, so why vote? Well, are they wrong?
Well, yeah, there's no money in it. I could attest
to
that.
Maybe at this level.
I could attest to that. I probably spent more money than I made doing this type of work. I think it's a cynical view. I get it. I talk to people in reference to those same issues, trusting government. Why should I vote? What difference does it make? I think we're seeing the difference now at the national level for a wide variety of reasons.
You encourage active engagement, and yet this city is known for dragging its feet on fulfilling public records requests, and the city council goes into closed-door session to offer a payout to the police chief for a lawsuit that wasn't even filed and offers bonuses to city attorneys worth more than most city employees make. So how does that inspire confidence in government, in leaders, or in making voting a worthwhile exercise?
Well, Mike, I love the way you weave that question. That was a great way to do it. Listen, I think on the city council now, we got some issues and some noise that's been coming out of council for the last 4 weeks. A couple of things I think we need to address. One, I think we need to better facilitate our meetings. I think we need to really stick to the rules of the council. I think how we process our work matters.
But it's not just council. It's city staff. I mean,
I was going to get to that.
Okay, go ahead.
I was going to get to that. How we facilitate our meetings, how we process our work, getting more disclosure out of the management team. Our default position should not be to disclose less. It should be to disclose more. And I've been saying that religiously over the last year and a half, 2 years, that there's something wrong with the culture internally and our governance structure.
And we're throwing around a lot of money. Let's be honest about this. You just paid the police chief $305,000, and he's going to leave in January, but you paid him a retention bonus. So I don't know what that was about. Then it was revealed yesterday from WCNC-TV that Charlotte paid $77,000 for the police chief to move when he was an officer. When he became the chief, it is the regulation that you live in the community that you are the chief of police in. So he moved, and they paid him $77,000 to move. It wasn't that short long a move. I mean, he was already working here. Why $77,000?
Well,
how much does it cost to load up a moving van?
Well, that was the first I heard of that yesterday.
How can it be? You're on city council.
The police chief reports to the city manager. And that's an HR issue.
So is there
issue.
A problem in city management? Because this is not the first incidence of something like this. There's a lot of money being thrown
I think we have a governance structure problem. And I think that we have to, a culture, that we have to change the culture internally from a management perspective. I think our mayor needs to facilitate our meetings better. I think we need to look at how we process our work in terms of every major policy decision should go through a council committee. It does not. And those are things I've been articulating internally for a year and a half, 2 years.
I'm running short on time, but there are a lot of things it seems the council is surprised by. Mm-hmm. And you're in charge, allegedly. And seriously, I guess maybe the city management team is more in control of things in council, but I'm not sure that's the way it was intended to be. You just talked about better facilitating and better being more transparent.
For sure.
But you, when we initially found out about the deal with the police chief, we found out about it because of a leak. Mm-hmm. And you are a proponent of investigating and plugging those leaks on council. You've said it's really important because we have to build trust internally in the building as well as externally in the building. How do you build trust by plugging leaks when what's been leaked should have been leaked in the first place?
Well, I think you build trust by making sure that some of those decisions are done in public, like through a committee or advising council. I didn't know until we got there that night that we were talking about that particular issue. And there are times where we have to go into closed door sessions for corporate relocations, corporate retention, big things that need privacy issues, HR issues, and that we got to have some element of working in an executive session where things don't come out right until it needs to, and by law, those closed door records do come out eventually, right? But we can't work in an environment if we're trying to recruit a major Fortune 500 company to Charlotte. There's a secrecy around that, and it gets leaked.
Malcolm Graham is a member of Charlotte City Council. He's also been a member of the State Senate of North Carolina, and his sister Cynthia died 10 years ago today at the hand of Dylan Roof in Charleston. His book is called The Way Forward, Keeping the Faith and Doing the Work Amid Hatred and Violence. Thanks for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.